We're missing a chair here, so we were waiting to see if he was going to come. I think he might be at a meeting and it might be taking him a little longer than to be expected. So I'll go ahead and get going here. I know everybody wants to get going. Today we're going to be doing this joint meeting and taking in some information, presentation from and talking about the Minnesota Water Sustainability Framework in Minnesota. And we have with us today Deborah Schwackhammer. And welcome to the committee. Now, we talked before the committee started. It'll be about a 40 to 45-minute presentation. And she's claiming that she will answer your questions as she goes along. So we'll just hold, in other words, we'll just hold all the questions until we get done. So welcome to the committee.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. My name is Deb Schwackhammer. I'm a professor at the University of Minnesota. I have appointments in the School of Public Health and at the Humphrey School of Public Affairs, and I'm the co-director of the university's Water Resources Center. I served as the project director of the Minnesota Water Sustainability Framework, and I have with me the project manager, Jean Coleman, from CR Planning, and she's here to help me answer all the questions that you might have at the end of my presentation. I also want to let you know that I'm currently teaching a graduate class in water policy, and I wanted to give them some real-world experience, and so my class is actually here watching this hearing. So
welcome.
Be nice to me.
We're always very nice in the Senate, I might add.
Thank you very much.
Welcome, everybody.
Thank you. I'd like to give you about a 45-minute presentation that covers the details of the Minnesota Water Sustainability Framework. It's a fairly involved plan that the legislature requested, and this is your opportunity to actually hear it directly from me, the details of that plan. You have about a 150-page booklet or a CD that goes along with this plan, and what I'd like to do is walk you through that. So the framework is a 25-year plan to protect, conserve, and enhance the quantity and quality of the state's groundwater and surface water. It's an approach that is to achieve sustainability. It's an approach that is comprehensive, meaning that we are addressing for the first time in the state, we're addressing how to manage water from both water quality and water quantity at the same time, to address surface water and groundwater management at the same time, and to address human use of water as well as ecosystem use of water at the same time. And so that's the comprehensive nature. Right now we manage water fairly in silos. We manage groundwater, we manage surface water separately, we manage water in very well-defined ways, which is good, but we don't manage it in a comprehensive way. And finally, this plan is an integrated plan. It looks at the governance and the fact that we have so many agencies and people that manage water, and it looks to make sure that we do the best job in an integrated management way. I can tell you what the framework is not. The framework is not a spending plan for the Clean Water Fund. This framework really was requested by you, the legislature, to develop a set of recommendations that together would bring us to sustainable management of our resource. It is not restricted to the Clean Water Fund. It's not restricted to funds at all. Many of our recommendations don't cost any money at all. They really are about building a framework for in 25 years we will be in a position of managing our water in a completely sustainable way. So what is sustainable? The legislature also provided us with a definition of sustainability. And so sustainable water use is when we do not harm ecosystems, degrade water quality, or compromise the ability of future generations to meet their own needs. This was put into law in the actual law that appropriated the funds to do this framework. And in order to have a sustainable environment, you actually need a sustainable economy, and you need a sustainable social structure. And so we address all three of these aspects of sustainability: environmental sustainability, economic sustainability, and social aspects of sustainability. The legislature requested us to address drinking water needs, stormwater, agricultural use of water, industrial use of water, surface and groundwater interactions, infrastructure needs, and how all of these different uses interact and are affected by climate change, land use, development, and demographics. In addition, we were asked to identify the best management practices for wastewater treatment, drinking water source protection, pollution prevention, conservation, and water valuation. And we have those as appendices to the document that are found on our website. We were requested to take a collaborative approach, but I can assure you at the university that's one thing we do quite well, and we enjoy doing that. We are independent, of course, of the legislature and of the executive branch, and so we were asked to do this framework so that we would be free to do an independent plan and to pull together all the best minds in the state who deal with water. And so that was really the intent here, was to put together a coalition of folks, the best minds in the state, to do this plan. So we involved all of the various state agencies that deal with water, and you can see all those acronyms over there on the left. We also involved all the local units of governments, from counties and cities to non-government organizations and to the various watershed and water management organizations. The approach we took was, again, very collaborative and very involved. We first formed, the Water Resources Center is at the University of Minnesota, and we first formed a Headwaters Council. This was our external review panel. This was 30 folks that collectively had more than 300 years of water management experience under their belt. And so these were the thought leaders from around the state and region to advise us on whether we were being big and bold enough and whether we were keeping on course with what the legislature had asked us to do. So this was our external touchstone. We also wanted to make sure that we had citizens and stakeholders involved from the get-go. We did not want to do public engagement at the very end of the project, have a 30-day comment period, and say we involved the public. We involved the public from the very beginning. We had an advisory group whose sole responsibility was to make sure that we had public comment and public involvement coming into us and that all of our activity was informed outwards from us. And so that group played a very important role in keeping us engaged with the public and the citizenry. We approached this problem of how to build this framework. We approached it from a committee structure. First, we needed to know what did we know and what don't we know. In order to solve a problem, one has to know those things. And so we had five committees that were formed of experts that were to define what we know about a certain use of water and what we don't know about a certain use of water, and then also to frame what are the issues that must be addressed to attain sustainability. So we had a team that did domestic use, that looked at what we know about domestic use of water, what we don't know about domestic use of water, and what are the issues that need to be addressed to have sustainable use by domestic use of water. We had a team on energy and industrial use. We had a team focused on recreational, spiritual, and cultural use of water. We had a team focused on agricultural use of water, and we had a team focused on the ecosystem use of water. In addition, we needed teams to really tell us what we know and don't know about the policies of the state around water. So we had a policy team that assessed our past water policy, our current water policy, and then identified gaps in our policy around water. We had a team on education that looked at what we know about education delivery around water, both formal and informal, what we know, what we don't know, who does it, who does it well, who should do it. They identified those kinds of gaps. And then finally, we had a team of economists that looked at what are the ways that we value water from an economic perspective. Finally, we had a synthesis team. We had an awful lot of people involved. We had a lot of information that was gathered. And so we created a synthesis team. And the purpose of this team was to do exactly that. It was to bring all of this information together, synthesize it, and put it all together into the framework. This group did the heavy lifting. They met for a half a day every week for about 15 weeks, and they pretty much donated their time. This group was a marvelous group of people from around the state, from many different perspectives, that ultimately put this framework together. And I need to tell you that, in fact, although the synthesis team did a great deal of work, I want to assure you and I guess underscore the fact that the framework really comes from the University of Minnesota. It was not a consensus document. We did not want it to be a consensus document because, as you all know, when you go for consensus, you often go to the lower common denominator. We wanted a very bold plan. The issues that we identified were consensus issues. The approaches that we identified were largely and had widespread approval from the group, but the specific recommendations we debated at length, and I will tell you there was not always agreement on those recommendations, and I think that's what makes them very interesting and I think very forward-looking. We had many different people involved in this. Ultimately, more than 200 people participated in this project. And when I say participated, I don't mean they read a letter or did a review. They participated in a substantial way. And you can see that from this list that we had people from all walks of life, all different perspectives, all different uses of water. So we really made sure that we were as inclusive as possible in who participated in this effort. We produced three white papers that were foundational for the project, and these were produced by the University of Minnesota. And we had a paper that put together everything that we know about water use in Minnesota. We had a paper put together about everything we know about water supply in Minnesota. And finally, a third paper on what we know about the quality of Minnesota's water. These data are available, but they're sort of scattered amongst all the agencies and the federal government. These papers brought them all into one place. And if you're interested in the details of these papers, you can find them on our website. We also heard presentations from the State Climate Office. We heard presentations from the State Demographer's Office. And we had presentations from the University of Minnesota on land use so that we understood the context of water use within these much larger drivers of change in Minnesota. We also had white papers prepared by each of those teams that I talked about. These are the papers that told us what we know about a given issue, what we don't know about a given issue, and then put together what are the issues that have to get addressed in order to reach sustainability. So these eight white papers, plus the three I just referenced, are all available on our website. These are all background materials. They're not the final report. These are essentially appendices that went into developing the framework. But I wanted to make you aware of all this information that is available. It's great late-night reading. I really, trust me. So the framework addresses 90 particular issues, but they're organized under 10 big issues. So if you think about, if someone were to say, what are the 10 issues that confront the state when it comes to water resources, there's really about 10 of them, and I'll talk about them in detail. And they fall into the categories of environmental issues, social issues, and economic issues. The environmental issues, and I'm going to go through these in much more detail, but I want to give you a primer of these specific issues because I'm going to refer to them quite a lot. The first is the need for a sustainable and clean water supply for the state. The second is the issue of excess nutrients and conventional pollutants. The third issue is contaminants of emerging concern. I'll define some of these terms for you in a minute. The fourth issue is the connection between land and water. The fifth issue is ecological and hydrologic integrity, the need to restore those and have those. And the sixth environmental issue is the nexus between water and energy. In addition, we have two economic issues that were identified: water pricing, the issues around water pricing, and the issues around funding infrastructure needs. And then finally, we have two social issues that were identified, and I'll talk about the need for citizen engagement and education on water issues, and the need around some changes in governance and institutions to maximize our efficiencies towards reaching sustainability. Now, we have four overarching drivers that really have a huge impact on our water resources, whether we want them to or not. And these include climate, demographics, where people live and how old they are and where they're living, how people use the land, and our energy policy. These four things are not independent. In fact, they are all related to one another. The more people you have, the more energy you have. If the climate gets warmer, we need more energy. If we use more land differently, then it's going to have impacts on energy needs, et cetera. So these are very large drivers of change, and they're all related. And the thing that I want to convey to you is that these water issues are also interrelated to those drivers and to each other. One cannot just focus on one of these issues in isolation. They're all related. So if we were to only address contaminants of emerging concern, we really wouldn't solve the problem because it's related to other needs. For instance, contaminants of emerging concern are going to affect our infrastructure needs because of wastewater treatment technologies. They're going to cost more money. And the infrastructure needs are related to energy because it takes more energy to use new technologies in water treatment. So these things are all very related. And I'm going to talk about them as if they're linear and not related, but they are very related. And I really wanted to make that point. They're also very much affected by social issues and by economic issues. These are not in isolation of one another. So the framework addresses all of this. If there was one slide that sort of tied it all together in a very messy way, this is the slide. For each of these issues, in the report that we've provided to you, we provide the name of the issue, obviously, and then for each issue, we've described the problem. I recognize that you're not all experts in water quality, and I don't expect everyone or anyone necessarily in the legislature is an expert on all these issues. So we provide a problem statement to sort of give you the reason that we think this is a major issue. Then we give you the desired Minnesota future condition. This really is an aspirational, futuristic, what do we want the future to look like in 25 years? And that's so that we kind of have our eyes out on the horizon. We then provide an objective and a strategy for what we want to do to fix the issue. So there's the what. What do we do to address the issue? And then we have recommended actions for how to implement the strategy. And this is where we deviate from most other water plans you may be familiar with. Most water plans say this is the problem and this is what you need to do. And we also say, how would you do it? And the reason we did that is because the legislature asked us to. We were asked to do a detailed plan to develop the actual strategies and recommended actions for how to reach sustainable water management. We have benchmarks for measuring progress. Obviously, we need to know what the outcomes are going to be, and then we need measures to know if we're getting there or not. We also have an implementation schedule. We have a very broad thinking plan here. It's a 25-year plan. You can't start it all at once. You can't do it all in the first biennium. This needs an implementation schedule so that you can see that some things start now, some things should start later, some things can wait even longer. And we provide that information for you to help guide your choices. And finally, we have an impact matrix that provides for demonstrating cost versus impact. So we can give you some idea for what's the relative investment going to be in terms of cost and what kind of impact will it buy you. So we provide a lot of information for you in this plan. So for every single issue, these are the kinds of data and information and text and all that kind of thing that are provided for you in the plan. Now what I'd like to do is walk you through those 10 issues. I'm going to spend more time on some issues and less time on others, not because any of them are less or more important. I just think that some are a little, I'd like to emphasize a few for you so that otherwise we'd be here 2 hours, and I don't think anyone wants that.
Yes.
So I will walk you through these issues. I'm going to spend a little more time on the first issue, only so that you can see the kinds of data and information we are providing you, and also because I do think this is probably the most important issue. The issue is the need to have a sustainable water supply, and by what we mean here is enough water into the future that's of sufficient quality. If you don't have clean water and you have lots of it, that doesn't really help. You need abundant, clean water for the future. Why is this an issue in Minnesota? We're the most water-rich state in the lower 48. But, in fact, we do need to be concerned with this. One problem that we have is that population is growing, and this may or may not be a problem from your perspective, but in terms of water use and water demand, as population grows, we will also see an increase in water demand. In fact, our population growth by 2035 will have gone up 22%, almost another million people in the state, and by that time we'll need another 35% of water because our water use is growing faster than our population. And so we will need another third of our water supply just to stay even with today. That is a fairly awesome concept, that we're going to need another 35% water supply just to stay even. However, there's also some other concerns that maybe we don't have that kind of supply available to us. One study was done by the DNR and the Environmental Quality Board that estimated how much water the metro area would use as a percent of the available water. And so this was basically a forecast, a pretty rough back-of-the-envelope calculation, but you can see on the right-hand side the map that shows those purple counties. Those are the counties that by 2030 are projected to actually have exceeded the demand for water over what's returned to the system by about the ratio would be at 50% or greater. So we would be using more than half the water that's available by that time. This is a big red flag. It doesn't say we're absolutely going to go there, but it does say we might want to pay attention. We don't have unlimited water supply. On the left-hand side, you'll see another map that shows regions of the state where it shows basically the availability for high-capacity uses. And it It indicates where there's lots of water, essentially, and then not much water at all up there in the Arrowhead. And this is simply to show you that even where we think of us as having abundant water, we don't have abundant water in all parts of the state. And so we have to take that into account. We can't treat the state's water as one big bathtub. It's really distributed very differently around the state, and we need to take that into account. So what do we want for the future? We want water of sufficient quality that's protected for all future generations. So our first strategy is to determine our water balance. You might say, well, gee, don't we already know that? So by water balance, I mean how much is coming into our water system, how much are we using, and how much is leaving. So think of it as a bank account. It's very much like a bank account. So if you have a bank account and you know how much you're spending like crazy, but you have no idea how much you're depositing and you have no idea how much is in that account to begin with, you're not being very fiscally responsible. And that's essentially what the state is doing. We're not being water fiscally responsible. We're spending our water, and we know exactly how much we're using. We have wonderful data to tell us how much water we're using. What we don't have is data on how much water we have in storage, and we don't have data on how much is refreshing those aquifers. It's a bit of a surprise, but because we're so water-rich, I think we take it for granted. So we need to determine this water balance. Just as you want to be fiscally responsible and understand your bank account, we need to understand the state's bank account. That's the clearest way I can put it. So this is our number one recommendation, is to determine the water balance by accelerating the county geologic atlas and aquifer characterization mapping that the DNR, the Minnesota Geologic Survey, and the University of Minnesota are currently working on to accelerate that process. Right now they're on about a 20 to 25-year time frame of getting the data that would be needed to do this, and we're saying let's speed it up. Let's get this figured out and let's speed it up. So let's invest in determining our water balance. We also will need to do some modeling and some measurement taking. So we're recommending that a hydrologic monitoring network, a more extensive network than currently exists, be put into place to answer this question. We need very specific data to answer this, just like you need specific data from your bank, and we need to go out and get those data. So we're recommending that that be put into place. In addition, in the meantime, because this is a long-term investment, this is a 10 to 15-year investment to determine our water balance. So in the meantime, we need to do something to make sure we are managing our water availability correctly. And we're recommending, we have a number of recommendations, I won't go into all the details, to improve our appropriations or water withdrawal permitting system. Currently, the DNR is in charge of that permitting process. It's an okay process, but certainly it could be improved. And there are other states that have models that we can adopt, I think, quite well that would improve our permitting process very well. We could make it electronic. Ours is currently not. We could take, in effect, cumulative withdrawals so that if your neighbor's withdrawing water and you want to withdraw water, that both of those are taken into account. We look at other aspects of that permitting system to improve it. We have very specific recommendations for how to improve our water withdrawal permit system. And that would be in the near term. Our second strategy is to reduce the public health risk from drinking private well water that's contaminated. We think, although private well water, obviously the well belongs to the homeowner, we also are concerned that there are a number of citizens, more than a quarter of our citizens drink private well water, and we know that a good bit of it can be contaminated, and they might not even know it's contaminated. So we want to gather data by mapping these private wells. The Department of Health would be in a very good position to do this. To collect data on contamination of well water at the time of home sale or refinancing, so there's a mechanism to gather data, and that we offer homeowners testing clinics to make sure that they have access to affordable testing so that they can find out what is in their well water, and then to educate folks also on the effects of the existence of these contaminants, including nitrates, arsenic, and bacteria. Now, these are one of the great luxuries of putting together this framework is we were able to think big and we were able to think long term. And as legislators, you know that thinking long term is a very difficult thing in your position. You're thinking biennium, you're thinking session, you're thinking this week's hearings. You don't have the luxury of always being able to think long term. And what this framework does is allows us to do that essentially for you. And so our recommendations are often going to take much longer than 1 year or 2 years. For instance, those first two red lines are how we would do the water balance. You can see that might take 15 years to determine our water balance. That's a tough thing to do when you're thinking about biennium investments. But here we have an opportunity to make an investment for the long term to determine our water balance. And we've been very honest with you how long these things take. We're not going to sugarcoat that. Many of these things take a lot of time. But I wanted to point that out to you. And finally, this is an example of the impact matrix I mentioned. We have cost on the vertical axis, high, medium, and low, and that's orders of magnitude, where low cost is under $1 million total. The medium cost is between $1 and $10 million total to implement a given recommendation, and the high is greater than $10 million for the overall recommendation. And the impact then is low, medium, high. That's a fairly subjective assessment of what the impact would be on improving water resources. 1A is that water balance recommendation. It would cost more than $10 million over 15 years. So again, it's spread out over time, but it would have huge impact. If there was a huge category, it would go in the huge category. It would have a huge impact, and it would be expensive. But it's a long-term investment. So these are the kinds of data we're providing you and the information we're providing you, not just a series of recommendations. We're giving you a sense of what they would cost. We're giving you a sense of their impact. And you'll also see that we'll give you a sense of when you should maybe consider doing them. Not all of them can happen right now. Let me move to the second issue. I've spent a lot of time on that first one just to give you the flavor of the document, but now we'll move to the second issue. And that issue is the existence of excess nutrients and other conventional pollutants in our water. You're all familiar, I'm sure, with the Clean Water Act and the process by which the state addresses the Clean Water Act. Nationwide, about 40% of the nation's waters are in excess of water quality standards and do not meet water quality standards. Minnesota is right there in the median. We are in the middle. About 40% of our waters are considered impaired, meaning that they do not meet water quality standards. I can't underscore for you enough that this particular issue means that we are out of compliance with federal law. This is not just, oh, let's kind of fix up our state's waters, it would make us feel good. This issue is a legal issue. It's a federal Clean Water Act issue. We are out of compliance with the federal Clean Water Act, and our recommendations are how to get us into compliance with the Clean Water Act and how to remove our waters from this impaired waters list and have us be the land of unimpaired waters. That would be our future. Now, what causes these impairments? What causes us to be out of compliance? It's really by a handful of pollutants. And these are currently the water impairments within the state. This is the distribution of the types of things that cause those impairments. About 25% of those impairments are caused by excess nutrients. About 30% is caused by toxic pollutants, and that's largely mercury existing in fish tissue. And so that's mostly the toxics bar there, the toxics pie. We have turbidity problems in about 20% of our waters. Turbidity is resuspended sediment and soil in water, causing a lack of clarity. So turbidity is a lack of clarity. Bacteria represent about 10% of our impairments, other biological impairments. And then the other conventional pollutants is a kind of a handful of other kinds of regulated pollutants where we are in violation of water standards. But eutrophication is about 25%, and that correlates largely with the existence of the bacterial and turbidity problems. And so those three pies kind of correlate together and cause more than half the impairments in the state. Now, by excess nutrients, I'm talking phosphorus and nitrogen. Those are the two nutrients of concern in the state. And this shows you the sources of phosphorus in Minnesota. And again, it's to make sure that for those of you that aren't following all of the discussions around phosphorus or nitrogen or other pollutants that I might talk about, it's these kinds of data that we've provided you so that you get a sort of a nutrients 101 along with everything else in the framework. So we've provided these kinds of background information. This shows you that for phosphorus in Minnesota, which is a major impairment, we have the cause of the problem, about 45% is caused by point sources, and a little more than half is caused by non-point sources. And by point sources, we mean things that you can point to as coming out of a pipe. And these are all regulated through the MPCA issues permits through the NPDES permit system So the point sources are handled by that process. And you can see that human waste, processed water are the two biggest things there, and other kinds of waste. The non-point source is driven by atmospheric deposition. You might not have known that. That's a fairly little-known fact, I guess. A lot of our phosphorus does come from the atmosphere, but more than a third comes from cropland and pasture runoff and from other agricultural uses of the land. Urban runoff is about 10%, and sewage treatment systems are about 10%, and then you see a whole bunch of little categories all in those little pies. But on the non-point source, it is dominated by agricultural use and atmospheric deposition. Nitrogen, the source of nitrogen, we don't have good data just for the state of Minnesota, but we look like a lot of other states in the upper Midwest that are agriculturally based. And there have been many national studies that have looked at the Mississippi River and looked at sources of nitrogen to the Mississippi River. And from those studies, we can infer kind of what nitrogen, what drives our problems with nitrogen in this state. And you can see that since about the 1970s, fertilizer use has been a dominant driver of nitrogen in systems. In fact, starting about 1970, we've added more nitrogen than can be mineralized by soil. So the excess nitrogen runs off, gets into our waterways. But it's the sources of nitrogen are dominated by fertilizer use, crop use and pasture use, and then to some extent, actually, animal manure has been pretty constant over time. But it's largely driven by fertilizer use. And a recent study by the USGS looked at whether we have a problem or not with nitrogen. And as you know, nitrogen, as you may know, nitrogen is not necessarily a groundwater or a surface water pollutant unto itself causing ecological problems. It's a human health problem in terms of getting into our drinking water. And so the USGS looked at stream water and at shallow groundwater drinking water systems from around the nation to look at those systems that exceed the drinking water standard. And in fact, you can see that it's agricultural systems that use shallow groundwater which have the most problem, meaning that people living in agricultural land drinking shallow groundwater are the ones that have the most chance, the most risk of drinking water that's contaminated with nitrate. And nitrate, although it doesn't really hurt adults too much, it can be lethal to infants. And this graph shows what we do know about Minnesota, because I think it's important to appreciate some of the data that we do have from Minnesota in order to understand our recommendations better. So since the 1950s, the MPCA has actually been collecting data at about 80 what they call milestone sites. These are sites around the state that are representative of the state. And so we have about a half a decade's worth of data. And this shows the percentage of those sites that have an increasing or decreasing pollutant trend or no trend at all. A decreasing trend would be good. We want that pollutant to go down. And an increasing trend would be bad. And so you can see that many of these pollutants are showing decreasing trends. And so if you look at total suspended solids, 41%, almost half of the state sites over time have improved. The bad news is about half show no trend at all. So half have improved and about half haven't shown any improvement. If you look at phosphorus, that's a pretty good story. We have about 78% improvement, but unfortunately we have about 20% of the state, which is recalcitrant, that's not improving at all. So we have 20% of the state that is not getting better in terms of phosphorus, and that's probably driving those impairments that I talked about before. And then we have nitrate, and this story is not so good. Here we have only 1% of those milestone sites showing improvement. 75% show an increase in nitrate concentrations. And this is the story that's also being seen nationwide. This relates to the data that I just showed you. And the other quarter show no trend at all. So we're not seeing very much improvement. And partly that is because we don't have surface water or groundwater standards for nitrogen to protect the environment. We only have them for human health purposes. So we've not paid as much attention to nitrate as we probably should. So what is our strategy around this? I've kind of given you a primer on these pesky nutrients, and so what can we do about them? Our first strategy is to develop statewide guidance for nutrient enrichment management plans. This is basically to say, let's manage nutrients regardless of their source. Let's not just manage nutrients coming from wastewater treatment plants or just nutrients coming from fertilizer coming off of lawns or just nutrients coming from some other source. Let's manage them collectively, because a phosphorus molecule doesn't know if it came from a wastewater treatment plant or from a farmer. It just causes eutrophication. So let's manage them regardless of their source at the watershed scale, but let's have common guidance from the state. So that's our recommendation, our strategy and recommendations for how to develop these management plans. Now, we know that nutrients co-vary with turbidity issues and pesticides and bacteria, so these plans really should address all of those pollutants, but address them regardless of the source. Now, how are we going to implement such a strategy? First off, I'm sure you're, again, familiar with the TMDL process. I know I sat in on your previous hearing for the Environment and Natural Resources Committee, and I know you had some discussion around this. We are required by the Clean Water Act to do assessments of water to find out if they're impaired. If they are impaired, we are then required by law to do a study to determine what the allocation of pollutants is and how much it has to be reduced. Think of it as a diet. So someone studies you, me, and says, oh, you need to go on a diet. You need to cut out this many calories, and it's from these sources. It's from, you know, you have to eat less vegetables and you have to eat more bananas or something. So basically that's what we do with the TMDL. We allocate the pollutant reduction strategy for a given pollutant. We say how much of a given source of that pollutant needs to be reduced. Now, these implementation plans for then how to enact that plan. So okay, now I've got my diet. So my nutritionist has handed me the diet, but I throw it away, or I file it, I should say. But in fact, what we really should do is require that I follow the plan, right? If I really want to lose weight, if I really want the state's water to get better, we should follow the plan. And right now, we don't require these implementation plans to be implemented. We just require the plans to be done and put on a shelf. They're not required to be implemented. We do all this work. We spend millions and millions of dollars on these studies, and then we don't require them to be implemented. The federal government requires up to that point, but it doesn't require the implementation. So let's follow through and do the implementation and clean up our lakes and rivers. In order to do that, we have specific recommendations around accelerating the TMDL process, requiring compliance timelines, requiring effectiveness monitoring so we know that something is going to happen, and requiring consequences if you do not implement these plans. Instead of just planning and talking about it, let's clean up the water. We have other recommendations around reducing nutrients and conventional pollutants from lots of sources. We have recommendations around stormwater, recommendations around shoreland rules, and we have recommendations around septic systems. So we're looking at all the various sources collectively of these different nutrients. Now, the second strategy is how are we going to actually do this piece about if we require implementation to be mandatory, how are we going to bring everyone to the table? I've just talked to you about the fact that agriculture practice is certainly one of the major sources of both nitrogen and phosphorus to our waters. They are regulated differently than the point source community, and they do not have individual permits, nor would we ever want to see individual permits be required of individual agricultural farmers or producers. It makes no sense whatsoever to have them treated as point sources. However, they are part of the cause, and so how do we have them be part of the solution? This has been a national discussion. I'm sure it's been a state discussion for a long time, but we have a series of recommendations for how to have agriculture be at the table as part of the solution to our water pollution problems and how to fix it. So our recommendation is to establish a process that is farmer-led and performance-based, first and foremost, in order to meet water quality standards in agricultural areas. Imagine a watershed that is out of compliance for nutrients, and so they're in violation of the Clean Water Act. How can we have that pollutant reduction take place and still include agriculture? Our recommendation is to collectively take the agricultural owners of the land that is owned and used for agriculture, have them cooperatively decide how they're going to meet the overall reduction from agriculture collectively. They get to decide how to do it. They get to decide who does it. Nobody tells them how. And if they already meet that load reduction, nothing happens. No permits, no paperwork, no violations. But this is a process that would allow the agricultural community to decide how to meet those load reductions and how to do it themselves. That's the plan that we have recommended. These thresholds would be decided by the TMDL process. It's a question of how they would then meet those TMDL allocation reductions. So that's the recommendation that we have for how agriculture could be part of the solution, we think, in a very equitable way to make sure that everyone helps achieve clean water. This is not a trivial recommendation, and it is not a short-term recommendation. I believe very strongly this recommendation would take about 10 years to implement. It will not happen overnight. We are not recommending some new law come down, you know, like a curtain on July 1st of 2011. We are recommending that this process be implemented over a 10-year period and that the agricultural community be part of that implementation process, the development of how this would get implemented. So this is not a short-term process or a we need this to be a thoughtful process because this is a very bold recommendation. It needs to be done well, and it needs to be done right, and it will require about 10 years to do that. And that's what this graph shows. It shows that it would be more than 10 years to actually implement these recommendations. So I don't want to dwell on this, but I just want to point out that, again, this is a long-term investment in meeting sustainable use for our water and in cleaning up our impaired waters, which, again, is required under federal law. The third issue is contaminants of emerging concern. Now, here the problem is that we have, I talked about a 5 or 6 contaminants just now for the impaired waters issue. We have hundreds of other contaminants we can measure in our water, both our surface water and our groundwater and our drinking water. Hundreds. They're not regulated because we don't know enough about them. We just know how to measure them. So we're really good at measuring. We don't know the toxicity, but we do know they cause harm. This odd-looking graph overlay of the United States and the right shows a study that was just done by the USGS that found that at all those sites that were sampled, which are all the little blobs that you see on that map that cover most of the United States, those are the major river basins in the United States, they found at 31% of the sites the fish that they caught had both male and female gonadal tissue. So that's called intersex. So these fish can't reproduce. They have both male and female sexual organs. So these fish are pretty impaired. 31% of the sites in the United States that were sampled. So this is not a trivial problem, and it's not. This is evidence that we should probably pay attention to these kinds of contaminants. We know that these contaminants correlate with this kind of what's called intersex. What do we want for the future? We want to have a lot less of these contaminants in our drinking water, right? What is our strategy? We have two strategies around this issue. The first is to, what we say, move upstream. Let's not put these contaminants into our environment in the first place. Let's prevent that by moving the state towards green chemistry and manufacturing, by moving our manufacturing sector to be using more environmentally friendly and less environmentally harmful original materials, starting materials, and producing less toxic products. I should have mentioned that many of the source of most of those contaminants I'm talking about are from consumer products. So they're things like things added to shampoo to make it smell nice or to make it suds more. So these are consumer products that get into our wastewater streams that get put out into the environment. So let's make our consumer products more safe. Again, this is a national movement, but let's help our businesses in Minnesota move to a green chemistry approach. The second is to manage those that already are here. So we have hundreds already in the water. So the first strategy is to fix it in the future. The second strategy has a number of very specific recommendations for how to deal with the fact that we already have these contaminants in our water supply. I'm not going to go into the details, but I wanted to let you know about that set of strategies. The fourth issue is the land-water connection. This is how we use the land definitely affects our water. I want to remind you that the water in Minnesota, we pretty much have one source of water in Minnesota. It's called rain and snow. We're at the top. We're at the headwaters of most of the country, of the continent. And so our water doesn't flow in from other rivers and streams and lakes. It starts here. It comes from the atmosphere, and then it flows out. We export water. So our water starts pretty clean. It's coming from the atmosphere. The problem is that once it lands once it falls on the land, we end up polluting it. And so we need to be mindful of how we use the land because it's ultimately what affects our water. Our first strategy is to integrate water and land sustainability planning. Right now, this kind of planning takes place separately. We have comprehensive planning that takes place by the counties. We have water plans that take place by the counties. most of the time in many counties. That's done by different people at different times, different scales, different geographic scales. It's not done at the same time in the same place. It's not integrated. This, to me, is kind of a no-brainer, I have to tell you. I don't do land or water planning at the local scale, but I have to say doing it together at the local scale just makes a lot of sense to me. So I think that this strategy just makes a lot of sense. We have specific recommendations for how to do it. I appreciate there are barriers to changing how we do planning, but it doesn't mean that we can't get there. So we have specific recommendations for how to change our permitting processes, how to make our planning more effective. The next issue is the issue of maintaining and achieving hydrologic and ecologic integrity. You cannot have a healthy environment without healthy people and a healthy economy. And you can't have a healthy economy without healthy ecosystems. Think about our economy. It's based in agriculture and tourism. They're the top two sectors. That's the environment. We need a healthy environment in order to have those two aspects of a healthy economy and then to have healthy people. So these are all interrelated issues. And where water flows, that's the hydrologic piece, has everything to do with our ecologic integrity. So we have one strategy has to do with protecting our critical aquatic ecosystems, and we have very specific recommendations for how to do that. And then we have a strategy around invasive species, aquatic invasive species, and again, we have very specific recommendations for how to better address invasive species in the state. We have a third strategy around the hydrologic integrity issue. And this strategy, the strategy is a fairly philosophical one. It's basically to keep more water on the land and slow it down. We have spent about the past 150 years working very hard to move water off the land very quickly to improve agricultural productivity. And that's fine, but the problem is we kind of went too far in one direction. In the last 30 years, we've definitely moved back to keeping more water on the land and protecting our wetlands and putting in buffers and that kind of thing. So the state gets a lot of credit for that. But we probably need to slow it down a little further. We've all seen the flooding that has taken place in the state, and it's not a trivial problem. And so one of the ways to address both flooding and address water pollution and runoff is to try to control that water flow a little bit better. So we have, as you can see, a whole series of recommendations around how to slow water movement and yet maintain agricultural productivity. First is to further develop our models for flood control. We have a couple of wonderful models being developed by the state that are at the pilot stage, and they really could be expanded. We're recommending they be expanded to statewide application, and I have a demonstration for one of those in just a second. We're also recommending that water models for how water flows be developed for the field scale. This is specifically to help farmers. This is specifically to help figure out when you have a 2-inch rainstorm, what happens to that water relative to your tile system, relative to the drainage system, relative to runoff, and how can you best manage the water on your farm. So we have specific recommendations around that. The third recommendation is that any new or replacement drainage tile incorporate some aspect of conservation. Not necessarily manage drainage tile, but incorporate some aspect of conservation management for the land. We have in the document, we list about 15 different types of conservation technologies that could be used effectively. And it would be to offset, basically, the impact of bringing water off from the tile drainage. The offsets could be anything from wetland restoration to berms to buffers to managed tile drainage. So it's not telling the farmer exactly what to do, but it's basically saying do an offset as you add new tile. And finally, Bowser has an incentive program already to retrofit existing tile and improve that tile drainage. This program is very small, and we're recommending that be expanded to help the farmers, provide money to help the farmers to replace poor or failing tile systems. Now, when I talk about models to help with flooding, this is an example of one of the models that has been developed by the DNR and the Army Corps of Engineers, where you take a region of the state, a little part of the state, and you forecast what happens if you put a 2-inch rainstorm in a 24-hour period on that land. What happens to that water? And you can predict how much of it, how much flow you get in various parts of the, in a three-dimensional model, and you can see how much water storage you have in that same time frame. What this allows you to do is to say, we shouldn't build here. If we're going to plan, let's not build here. This is probably why we're having problems here, because that is where the water goes. This gives you a three-dimensional forecast of where water goes. And we don't have that ability today. And this would give us that ability. Finally, we have a strategy around maximizing the placement of marginal lands and conservation protection. The state does a good job of this currently. The federal government has many provisions for this within the federal farm bill. But we would like the state to be mindful that many of these acres are due to expire, and that the agricultural community should be encouraged in every way possible to take marginal lands out of production, but to offset that with programs so that the farmer is not penalized. But we want to protect the land as well as protect agriculture. The next issue has to do with energy. Many people do not appreciate that energy and water are so interconnected. The major use of water in the state of Minnesota is energy. The major use of water, 67% of the use of water in the state of Minnesota, is for cooling purposes to generate electricity from coal-fired power plants. 67%. Agriculture is only like 8%. So energy is huge. So the more energy that we use, the more energy that we need, the more water we're going to need. That's very, very important. That means that as you plan for energy policy, you have to be thinking water policy. And as you do water policy, you have to be thinking energy policy. Wastewater treatment plants, shown on the left, huge user of energy. If we change and we build new infrastructure for wastewater treatment, huge amounts of energy will also be part of that equation. And then the biofuel issue has been, of course, front and center for many years. But if we go to additional ethanol plants, we will also see the need. That's a generation of energy that uses water. So you can see you need water to produce energy. You need energy to produce water. Our main recommendation here, understand those relationships and understand them quantitatively so you can do good policymaking. If you don't know how much energy is used to clean a gallon of wastewater, then you can't really make good energy policy. And if you don't know how much water it takes to produce a gallon of ethanol, you can't make good energy policy. So the recommendation here is pure and simple. Figure out those relationships. The state of California has done this. They have a whole table of what those relationships are. And as a result, they are doing a better job of managing, not a great job, but a better job of managing energy and water. Water pricing and valuation. As you all know, as a result of this body, we will be moving to conservation pricing across the state by 2013. We are recommending that some of the benefits of providing clean drinking water that are currently not part of that pricing scheme be included in the pricing structure. So with conservation pricing, there's a base price and then a step price to encourage conservation use. We're recommending a $5 fee be added to each water connection, so one each family essentially annually, $5 annually per family, to pay for those currently unfunded costs of having drinking water. Right now, we just pay for the distribution. We don't pay for the lost use of, say, the pollution caused by having a drinking water plant or a wastewater treatment plant. We don't pay for those costs. We pay for them indirectly. We pay for them through TMDL studies. We pay for them through other taxes. But why don't we just pay for them directly? It's a lot cheaper. $5 a year per family would more than cover that kind of problem. Infrastructure needs. We have tremendous infrastructure needs. We have two different kinds of needs. The first is we need new technologies. We know that we have these hundreds of contaminants in our water. We know we need to remove them. And unfortunately, that requires we have the technologies, too. We just know that they're going to cost a lot of money. And so we are recommending that a standing committee be formed to advise the government, to advise the legislature, to advise the MPCA, to advise the Public Facilities Authority on what these updates are. These technologies change almost weekly. This happens to be an area of research of mine. I can tell you the literature on this changes all the time. So we could make a recommendation. It would be out of date within a week. So we're recommending that this be a standing committee that reports to the government on what the best technologies would be for the future. The second strategy has to do with the fact that we're going to need to build new drinking water and wastewater treatment plants. You all know that, but the schedule for replacing them and building new ones is accelerating. The reason it's accelerating is we built all our wastewater treatment plants in response to the Clean Water Act in the 1970s and 80s. They have about a 40-year lifetime. They're all come and due about the same time, which means a lot of cost is going to come our way. We're not going to do without sewage treatment. We're not going to do without clean drinking water. And so someone's going to have to pay for these plants. Right now, the federal government pays for the vast majority of them, and the state legislature provides the necessary state match. But that upward tick shows you the gap in funding for the future. And by 2030, we're going to need a whole lot more money than what the state and federal government can provide. It means that the citizens are going to have to start kicking in for this. And we're going to need a process. We're going to need options for how this is going to work, and it needs to be planned for now instead of waiting for it to turn into it's a train wreck going to happen, but it hasn't happened yet. So let's plan for that train wreck and find options for it so it's not a train wreck. Citizen engagement and education is one of the social issues we identified. We really feel that citizens need to have a water ethic for all of these changes to take place, and for us to have sustainable water management, our citizens need to embrace this. We need to educate our kids. We need to educate our adults. We need to educate our decision makers. We need to educate just about everybody on water issues. Finally, the last issue is governance and institutions. Our first strategy is that we are recommending that the legislature review our current water policy and look to see that it's in alignment with water sustainability principles. Our water policy is excellent. Our water policy, however, was developed in a piecemeal fashion. It was developed in response to a certain issue, Wetlands Conservation Act, right? Groundwater Protection Act. We responded to issues. What we don't know and what we think we probably need to do is review those laws and look for whether they're in line with sustainability principles as put out by this framework. In addition, we need to look at land policies. We need to look at energy policies. I hope I've convinced you that energy matters a great deal in all of this, and transportation policies regarding water sustainability. Our final recommendation around this strategy is to reestablish the Legislative Water Commission that used to exist within the legislature back in the 80s. It was disbanded for funding cuts, bicameral, bi-party, bi-everything. Nonpartisan. Think of it as a nonpartisan commission. Water is a nonpartisan issue, and I think I've probably convinced you water issues are very complex, very long-term, and I think the legislature would benefit greatly by having a subgroup of you really devoted to understanding these issues in depth to advise your colleagues. The other strategies we have to do with governance. So we are recommending that a water sustainability board be formed. And before you get concerned and say, oh, no, not another layer of government, we can't have that, our recommendation is specific to dissolving two existing groups and forming one to actually take over those responsibilities and to have a little bit more oversight of the state's planning and compliance, if you will. The State Water Sustainability Board that we describe in our document would replace the water planning functions of the Environmental Quality Board, and it would replace the Clean Water Council. The Clean Water Council really is a vestige of the Clean Water Legacy Act and not the Clean Water Land and Legacy Amendment, and so its responsibilities are a little confused. The EQB is basically based in the executive branch, and so we're recommending a sustainability board that would have representation from both the legislative and the executive branches so that it would be a little bit more inclusive, and it would oversee these planning efforts that I'm talking about. It would make sure that there was compliance at the local level, at the watershed level. So it would provide more oversight. Right now, our water plans, they're reviewed, but then they're put on a shelf. Nobody approves them. Nobody says, you can't have any more money because your water plan stinks. Nobody says that, and this board would do that. We also are recommending that the watershed districts, the watershed management organizations, and the soil, water, and conservation districts that we're all familiar with, all 300 and some of them, be combined into a single authority within each watershed. So the watershed, instead of having two or three organizations, would have one. And it would stop a lot of this inefficiency and cross, I don't know that they work against each other, but certainly there's an awful lot of cooks in the kitchen. This recommendation is to simply reduce at the local level how many cooks are in the kitchen so it becomes more efficient. So we're recommending the forming of these authorities at the watershed scale. We also recommend that this framework not be put on a shelf, but it be reviewed formally every 5 years and updated so that this framework would be different in 5 years, hopefully because many of the recommendations would be adopted, hopefully because we would already see changes and we could actually move to focusing on a different set of recommendations. So we recommend that this framework should be a living framework. Now, I've given you an awful lot of information. I've gone through all 10 issues as quickly as I could. I've given you the sort of the top strategies and many of the recommendations that we have come up with at the university. And now I want to give you my top five. These are essential. I firmly believe that without doing these five things, we cannot achieve water sustainability. So these are essential actions. The first is to deal with our water quality, the need for having a sustainable water supply. Figure out our water bank account and revise the permitting system. That counted for one. The second one that I think is essential is that we require implementation of pollutant reduction plans. Instead of just doing the plan, I strongly think we cannot ever achieve clean water without requiring those implementation plans. And third is to address future contaminants. We can fix our existing contamination problems and our existing impaired waters, but we have hundreds of other contaminants out there that we need to deal with. The fourth is to integrate water and land use planning. I told you already, I already thought that was kind of straightforward, so I think that that's an essential, and I think it's a very attainable recommendation. And finally, to review our policies to make sure that they're in alignment with sustainability principles. Now, I told you that also, although not, I think every issue is very, very important, not every recommendation, not all these recommendations are equal. I'll be honest. We have 60-some recommendations in here. They're not all equal. Some are more important than others. And some are low-hanging fruit. Some are going to require investment now to ever see any kind of a outcome. And so we have recommendations for what should happen when. So we have, and there's much more detail in the plan. These are examples of what things should happen now. So we have many recommendations that need to happen now. Because you've got 25 years, this water balance is going to take 15. Start it now. So you can see a number of these issues need to start now. We have issues that can wait several years. The integrated planning can wait. I don't really want to see it wait, but you can make it wait. You have other things that are more important, I think, to act on. The water pricing isn't going to start for a couple of years. That can wait. So there are a number of issues that could wait. You don't have to act on them right now. Then we have issues that could probably start even 5 or 6 years from now. And then finally, the issue of water reuse, which I didn't touch on in this presentation but is in the framework. That is not something that we have a huge demand for right now. We have a process for it, but we don't have a huge demand. But I'm guessing in 10 years we should be well positioned to so that we can address that issue. But we probably don't need to address it within even this 10-year period. We provide for you in the executive summary and in the whole document something called a dashboard. Every single recommendation is provided and tells you who is the primary implementer of the recommendation, whether it's the executive branch or whether it's the legislature or whether it's someone else. It tells you whether it's a research action or not, whether it's something can just happen, it's something we can do right now, whether it should happen in phase 1, 2, 3, or 4, whether it has what level of benefit it has to water resources. The ones I've shown here are all very high, but we've tried to be very honest and tell you which recommendations are not as important as others. And finally, we indicate whether there are multiple benefits to other natural resources. So if you take this action, you don't just protect water, you protect fish, or you protect wetlands, or you protect birds, or you protect some other natural resource that's been identified as important to the state. With that, I will stop, and now I'm happy to answer your questions. I very much appreciate your patience in letting me just sort of talk nonstop, and now I'm happy to take your questions.
Thank you very much. Members, any questions? Senator Kielash.
Mr. Chair, one of the things that you touched on was the demographics and the increase for water use as we move forward. And can you just elaborate on what you're seeing in the demographics and the change in how Minnesotans will be using water in the future?
Ms. Rackenhoff.
Mr. Chair, Senator Kalash, I'd be happy to. I'm not the state demographer, but I'll try to paraphrase some of the important things that that office has pointed out to us. By 2035, the population will grow about 22%, so about another million people. But the more important aspect of that is that population will be moving around. Many of those folks will be baby boomers that are going to be looking for second homes on lakes up north, and so we're going to see demographic change of increased population in our lake districts and in the metro, interesting, but mostly in the lake districts. So where we have recreational waters, we will also see an increase in population. In addition, because that population is older, they will be putting less money into income taxes and into the state's coffers. And so there will be less money to protect natural resources because we'll have more demand on health and education and other aspects, which you're quite well aware of. So the demographic change is going to see more people. It's going to be they're going to be older. They're going to be wanting second homes on Lakeshore. And we're also going to see a significant increase in immigrant population, and it'll be by 2050, I believe the estimate is about 30% of Minnesota's population will be immigrant. And so that will also very much change the use of water and the value and the regard for water, I think.
Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That was quite a thorough presentation. Thank you for that. I just had a couple very simple questions. One, I was interested in that water capacity map, and we didn't have that handout in our packet, and it was hard to tell. I think it was about slide 16. If you could tell us, you know, I'd like to see those different areas, and I couldn't tell what the key was as far as where the water capacity was and where it wasn't. And
I believe you mean
yep.
This one?
Can you just read that key for us, please, so we can – maybe everyone else can see it, but I cannot read the key from here.
It's pretty hard. So the arrowhead, the darker purple, is not available. So there's very little groundwater there for high-capacity use, especially none. The pinkish area in the it kind of shows up yellow there. The yellowish area is where we have limited water availability. It's an isolated aquifer, so that's less available. That's the next least available. Then we have the middle part of the state, which is the glacial sands area, and that's available but only near the surface. And then we have multiple regional aquifers down in the lower right hand, the southeast corner of the state. So those are the four colors. Does that help?
It does. Could I just have a follow-up, yes, please? Thank you. In the southeast quadrant of the state where we have some of those available aquifers, I know we have karst geology there, and I'm just wondering if you can comment on how that might play into the quality of the water, even though there's a supply there.
Ms. Wackhammer.
Mr. Chair, Senator Nelson, I would be happy to. I'm not a geologist, so I also will say that. I'm a great generalist, so I know, you know, about this much about many of these aspects. In that region, it is karst geography, and therefore water moves very quickly to the groundwater. Because of that, it's very easy to pollute that water because of the connection between ground and surface water, so that more than any other area of the state, when you pump groundwater, you also affect the surface water. They're very connected. You need to think of surface water and groundwater in that part of the state as being kind of one water system. But it's very susceptible to pollution because of the very quick movement of water to the groundwater.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, just one follow-up question. So with that in mind, are your recommendations tailored to different parts of the state because of the different environments as far as water quality and water availability?
Mr. Chair, Senator Nelson, we very much recognize that the state is very diverse. In fact, in Minnesota, I would say that we are both fortunate to have this diversity, but it makes management of our natural resources very complicated because you can't just talk about aquifers. They differ in different parts of the state. We have layers of aquifers, making it very complicated. We have different challenges in different parts of the state in terms of the ecology we're trying to protect, the cold water streams up north versus what we're protecting down south. We use agriculture differently in different parts of the state. All of that is to say we we made our recommendations as flexible as possible so that they could be applied to the state differently for different reasons, so that we could recognize those differences. We know that one size doesn't fit all to fix these problems, so our recommendations are often performance-based as opposed to dictating what to do in a specific part of the state. We think that at the watershed scale, at the local level, is where people know best how to use the land and also how to manage the land to protect water. So we looked at that overarching kind of framework approach and tried to be performance-based, recognizing explicitly that one size does not fit all.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Dr. Swackhammer. In your dashboard, one of the first recommendations you have for the legislature is to restrict water exports from our state. I'm not clear on how we export water right now and how the legislature might act in a way to restrict that export. Could you give us an example of that, please?
Mr. Chair, Senator Peterson. That recommendation comes directly from experiences that our neighboring states have had. So the export of water has to do with the collection of water and export for commercial purposes. So it would have to do with bottling. So the states of Wisconsin and the states of Michigan have had nightmare stories of companies coming in, bottling their spring water or their groundwater, and then making a profit on it. And the excessive pumping has caused tremendous problems. It's not that anyone cares that someone makes money off their clean water. It's that they're using the water in such a way that it impacts the rest of the state or region. So Minnesota currently does not have any protections against that. So this would be a proactive way to make sure that we don't end up in some sort of lawsuit with a giant bottling company who's trying to bottle our lovely water and take it out state. So the export has to do with really commercial sale. The export of Great Lakes water, of course, is covered under the Great Lakes Compact. So it's not dealing so much with piping water to Arizona. This has to do with commercial bottling. Thank you.
Okay. Follow up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Doctor, second question I have relates back to participation from the municipalities. You know, I think for most of us, you know, if I have a problem with clean water, I'm probably going to quit paying my water bill in the city of St. Cloud where I live. And so my sense is, and having served on that city council, is that the municipalities have taken a lot of responsibility for planning ahead as for their water supply, you know, just separating that from wastewater right now. Is that an accurate assumption or is that not true?
Mr. Chair, right, Senator Peterson, yes, I believe that's true. The planning for future water supplies certainly takes place at the local level and is done well, I think, at the local level. The problem is going to be when you need yet more infrastructure to provide that clean drinking water or to clean wastewater, and we just don't have the funds to do that.
Follow up. So then the follow-up, Mr. Chair and Doctor, you mentioned as a first priority is to create this balance in terms of mapping needs and implementation. Do municipalities have those right now or don't they?
Mr. Chair, Senator Peterson, the what's necessary to do the water balance is a combination of aquifer mapping, so what's underneath the layers of aquifer that's in the subsurface, the county geologic atlases, which is a whole bunch of information around any given county, and also monitoring data. And although we have made progress on the atlases and the aquifer mapping, only, I would say, I don't know the exact number off the top of my head, but less than half of the, well, I want to say less than a quarter of the counties actually have atlases at this point and have that mapping that's necessary. So that's being done by the state at the county level. So that's being done in combat. The DNR is working with the Minnesota Geologic Survey and with the University of Minnesota to make those maps and to get those atlases done. And the monitoring is, of course, done by the state agencies. But it's moving at a fairly slow pace in order to get the whole water balance for the state. So the municipalities specifically are not doing that. That's being done by the state agencies and the university and the MGS, but it applies to the counties.
Thank you.
Senator Brown.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Swackhammer, forgive me if you address this, but any research that has been done on the effects that global warming may or may not have on sustainable water supply?
Mr. Chair, sure. Senator Brown. Yes, there's been quite a lot of work being done on water resources impacts from climate change. Both at the university, by some of the state agencies, have sort of working groups keeping track of the research that's being done elsewhere. And other states are doing a lot around this as well. So, in fact, I just yesterday received a very thick report from impacts on and adaptation strategies for climate change from the state of Wisconsin. So there's a lot of work and attention being given to this. We have a lot of data from the past 50 years of climate, to show how climate has changed. And so many of the strategies are being looked at is to try to project those changes in precipitation, changes in temperature, changes in when the rain falls and how intensely, and try to anticipate how that might impact the future.
Any other questions from the members? With that, on behalf of the two committees, thank you so much for the report, very thorough report. And if the members have any questions, I certainly you will be more than happy to address them at a later time.
Absolutely. I'd be happy to appear before the committee or meet with any of you individually. I'm sort of at this point, we're done with our reports, but I'm happy to serve as a resource for you in interpreting it. Thank you.
Very good. Thank you. Members, moving along here, we do have one more report here from the EQB. If we could ask them to come forward real quickly and just remind members, we do have some constituents that would like us to attend some of their affairs tonight. So if we can make this fairly quick, let's certainly try and do that. However, if you have any questions, certainly this is the time to ask. So. I'm going to ask Ms. Van Buren Hansen.
Good afternoon.
Well, welcome
Mr.
to
Chair
the committee.
Members. Thank you very much.
Thank
I'm
you.
Very happy to be here. My name is Princesa Van Buren Hansen. And before the meeting, you should have received a copy of our report, as well as a copy of the handout. And there should be copies of both available for the audience as well. I did bring a handful of actual hard copies of the report, so if anybody wants a copy of the report, just ask Mike for that, please. All right, I understand it's been a long day, and I'll do what I can to try to cover our 10-year plan relatively rapidly. First, though, I'd like to start by just telling you a little bit about the Environmental Quality Board, coming here speaking on behalf of the board. It was a board that was created by the legislature back in 1973. It's composed of commissioners from 9 of the state agencies and also includes 5 citizen members and a representative of the governor's office. When this board was created, it was with the understanding that environmental issues are very interagency in nature. And so there was a benefit in having a board that could address these multiple interagency environmental needs and challenges, and to do so in such a way that it included citizen members and provided a public forum for the discussion. Over time, the EQB has addressed many different issues, oftentimes changing with whatever challenges are arising, you know, relevant to the time period in which we're working. Most recently, the EQB is known for the work specific to a lot of environmental review efforts, as well as water sustainability. In terms of kind of the foundation from which the 2010 State Water Plan has risen, back in about 2005, the EQB began working with the DNR to address a statute asking us to look at water availability and where Minnesota was poised to meet the needs of both today and also looking to the future. And after we released that report in 2007, we moved forward with the request that the EQB continue the conversation to look at both water availability, but also how that fits in the larger context of cumulative effects, and also looking to the future and some of the future planning efforts as it relates to both water quantity and quality considerations. So through those two efforts, we engaged a number of different agency members, as well as public and other citizen members, but really laying the groundwork and ramping up of efforts that helped to develop a very strong 2010 state water plan. The EQB has been charged with doing these 10-year water planning efforts since the 1970s. We have a history going back to 1979, 1991, and 2000. Some things that have grown out of those efforts actually include the formation of the Board of Water and Soil Resources, as well as the county water planning efforts. When we look back at this rich history, what we see is that when we develop these plans, when we look forward with a vision for our resources, we're most effective when we can align behind that vision and work together. Most effectively, whether we're talking about the U framework, the state water plan, or other things, if we have citizen involvement, local government engagement, executive branch support, and then coordination with the legislature, it's when we're aligned together that we can be most successful in achieving the benefits we seek. And with all this, the Clean Water, Land, and Legacy Amendment really says that the citizens are behind this. They see value. Minnesota and its heritage and its economy, the environment, are very important to our state. And so it's our responsibility to be wise stewards, both for today and for future generations. Some of the goals of this 10-year planning effort that we engaged in were to define a vision under which we could all work together and align, recognizing that we had a need to be more clear in the direction we're taking. We also look at the various state agencies at the table. I listed the nine members of the EQB itself, and what we see is a diversity of programs. And so to address that, we built a very broad and adaptive framework that could be applicable to each of these various programs within the agencies. We also desire to articulate what are the state executive branch strategies that we're going to engage in the coming 10 years, but looking broader, looking much, you know, to the future beyond just these 10 years, so we can achieve sustainable water management. And lastly, we recognize that the concurrent University of Minnesota framework planning process was engaged in the same time period. And so, as Deb mentioned, she had about 200 members active in that, and about a third of them were actually from the executive branch itself. So everyone who is involved with the state water plan also served to inform the university framework. So there was very open dialogue, communication, and coordination through the past couple years. The report's really broken into three large kind of chapters. In the beginning of the report, we reflect on the past. We look at the past three state water planning efforts. We look at where we've been, what we've learned, what we've done well, and where some of those needs still exist. We've looked at some of the transformational things that have brought us to where we are today. And then the midsection of the report, we evaluate where are we at with the status of our water resources today. Reports were prepared by the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency, the Department of Agriculture, the DNR, and the Metropolitan Council. And those efforts are included as appendices to our report, but really tell us where are we today in our monitoring efforts, in our understanding of our resources, and which direction are we going. And then the real foundation to our report is this third part. It's charting a roadmap for the future. This is the real direction that we're taking. It's broken into strategies. We have nine strategies that tell us what we need to be doing as executive branch members in the coming decade. It builds on the foundation that we've been engaged in recent years through the Legacy Act and the Amendment Resources, as well as the EQB Water Sustainability Planning efforts. We also then have seven implementation principles, and those tell us how do we make sure that we're effectively employing these strategies. These are all very broad in nature, and really what I would suggest that you do is think of this as an operating manual. This is a manual for the executive branch to be effective and efficient in the coming years. And in all things, looking to quantity and quality both today and down the road as our goal. I don't have a lot of time, so I'm briefly just going to mention some of the strategies, but then what I'm going to do is I'm going to go into three examples of what I mean about how we can apply these strategies. Our strategies begin kind of proactive in nature, looking at if we employ protection efforts and if we promote wise and efficient use of our resources, employ technologies where available. It's much more effective to preserve our resources from the start than to try to restore them after they've been degraded or depleted. We also, just as Deb mentioned, recognize that it's our local capacity that's critical. It's local government, it's stakeholders, and it's landowners who oftentimes know what needs to be done, and we need to actively engage with them. We also are looking at employing the proper resource management units. Just as the PCA has been implementing their intensive watershed monitoring approach where they're going to a watershed scale, right now we're actively working with the DNR, and the DNR is looking at groundwater management areas. So we're not managing just point by point, but looking at the integration of a larger system. We also recognize that we need to collect prioritized essential information for decision makers. We have a lot of data already that has been collected, but we still have gaps. We need to prioritize what those gaps are. We also need to make sure that of the data that we have collected and what we are going to be generating, that it's in a format that is easily accessible, not just to technicians, but also to decision makers and stakeholders. We recognize that our landscape is very diverse. Deb did a great job of explaining that, and I'm sure many of you already understand that. It's a very heterogeneous, dynamic, changing system. And so with that, there's many, many different protection and restoration tools. And oftentimes we need to develop the right suite of tools for the landscape or the situation in which we're working. And with that, we need a very targeted approach to these various efforts to make sure that we're being as focused on priority areas and implementing our resources where we can. And lastly, as we look to various emerging threats, whether they be contaminants of emerging concern, aquatic invasive species, or even things that we haven't yet talked about today, the state needs to develop a systematic approach for addressing them. So those are the strategies. The seven principles tell us, how can we put these strategies in place? Well, first off, we need to really optimize the coordination from the local level, state, our federal partners, and so on, to make sure we're as efficient as we can be to avoid duplication and have open communication. We need to prioritize our resources, both our fiscal resources, but our staff, our time, and our various tools. We need to manage land and water comprehensively. Just as Deb talked about, we recognize that the system is very intricately related. As a raindrop falls on the landscape, it's affected by the landscape, it goes into the groundwater, and oftentimes it's discharged to the surface water. It's a cycle. And we need to recognize how those work together. And adaptive management is really critical to our success. We're going to continue to learn new information each and every year. So we need to actively integrate that information into our decision-making programs. And then we need to have goals, targets, and measures to tell us, are we making progress in the direction we want to? We need to continue to educate and reach out to our stakeholders and those involved. And lastly, we need to align behind this shared long-term vision. So I've talked about a lot of good things here, but what does it mean? What are we actually doing within the state agencies? How do we use this operating manual and put it in place? So I'm going to talk briefly about three examples. I'm going to speak to groundwater management areas, to the contaminants of emerging concern, and lastly, to the impaired waters program. I'm very glad for the questions earlier that asked Deb about this map, because I think now you're very well acquainted with it. But what this shows us is that as we look at managing our groundwater resources, we go from the northeastern part of the state, where there's very little available, to the southeast, where we've got many kind of the layer cake approach to aquifers, but they're vulnerable to contamination. So that means one-size-fits-all approach is not appropriate. And so the DNR is really looking at, in the past, we've looked at well permits kind of one well at a time to try to manage the system. And where that has served well in the past, we realize it's not the right way to approach the future. We need to look at a systems management approach to that. So as we're trying to define what these groundwater management areas might look at like across the state, these are the strategies from the state water plan that are being employed. First of all, there's a conversation that's going on right now about defining these that incorporates so many people from the various state agencies, but also local level. There's a very coordinated, very comprehensive way of looking at this, recognizing, too, the engagement of the landowners, the local government level as well, and realizing that groundwater management is also about looking at its context geologically, hydrogeologically, but also at the land practices, the various, the ecosystem in which the area is seated in terms of different landscape and soils features, and coming up with an approach to it. And as we're designing this groundwater management area approach, we're starting with the areas where there's conflict and some of the more critical needs right now. But the long-term hope of this is to employ adaptive management so in the future we can more proactively respond to planning efforts. So we're not just responding to where there's a groundwater conflict, but rather we're designing a system that can effectively be used in terms of mapping out toward the future to avoid potential conflicts. The second example is looking at contaminants of emerging concern. Here we have a map from the MPCA, and this shows us the various colored sections are ecological sections of the state, and the various dots show us surface water sampling locations for endocrine disruptive compounds. there's a similar map of groundwater locations. So right now the PCA is very active in sampling for EDCs in both the surface water and groundwaters of the state as we're trying to get a better handle on these contaminants of emerging concern that we don't yet understand very well. So we're collecting that information that's essential for decision making. And in the process, we're having really open dialogue about how it needs to be collected and how it can be available to decision makers and stakeholders. At the same time, the Department of Health is working on those issues related to standards and trying to better understand what parameters might need to be set in place so we can protect human health in Minnesota. And in all of this, working to apply that systematic approach so we can address both this threat but also have kind of a roadmap for dealing with similar threats in the future. And the third example I would like to talk about relates to impaired waters. And here we have a map. It's actually Morrison-Benton County. It's the Little Rock Creek area. What I want to highlight here is traditionally when we've thought about TMDLs and impaired waters, we think of surface water features. But what this highlights here is how Little Rock Creek surface water is needing to be understood in the context of groundwater use around it. So those dots around it refer to different kinds of wells, upgradient, downgradient, and around the Little Rock Creek area. So what the MPCA is doing right now is working with partners to understand that what we've traditionally thought of as a surface water program really is very groundwater related, and we need to have a comprehensive way, a very holistic way of looking at it, that groundwater, surface water interactions together. And so we're just on the front end of designing the systems where we can better understand those relationships. But what they'll do is they'll help us over time. So as we look at other surface water impairments, other TMDLs, we'll have tools in place to understand that groundwater-surface water interaction and how it relates to the problems being addressed. So in terms of the strategies that are being employed, it's to look at that comprehensive water management scale. It's also can help us to best decide what tools are most appropriate for addressing this impairment in this landscape. And then lastly, we really need to be targeted. We know we've been doing assessments of impaired waters for a while. We have a better understanding where the problems are in the state, but now it's time to look at that implementation part. So where do we target our resources for that implementation? Well, let me tell you about how we're actually using some technologies. I'm sure you've heard about LIDAR, but here it shows you on the left-hand side, we've got the LIDAR with a 3-meter resolution digital elevation model as opposed to the historic USGS DEMs there. And what you see is a more refined representation of the landscape, which will really help us to better understand where we can pinpoint some of the critical areas. As another example of what I'm talking about, here LIDAR data was used in a terrain analysis on the left-hand side to help ID critical areas within a single field landscape here. And what it does is it helps a user to define kind of vulnerable areas on the landscape with minimal data input, minimal challenge on the part of the user to see where they should target these critical areas. So this is a kind of a field scale. Let's take it up a little bit. Here we have a watershed scale. And what this helps us to see is, again, using that LIDAR data, it helps us to critically pinpoint that probably about less than 30% of the larger watershed are really identified as critical areas. So we can effectively, more precisely, pinpoint where we should be doing more investigation, where we should be putting practices on the ground. And so this is really the direction that a lot of our programs are taking, using technology, using better information, and sharing that data with each other. So when we look at where we've been, even in the last 10 years, say since the last state water plan, what I want to talk about here is that adaptive management is being applied within the executive branch. We've had this historic understanding that Minnesota is water rich. I fully agree with that. But what we are seeing is that that abundance isn't equally distributed across the state. So we've gone from a feeling of being water rich to one of understanding that we do need to manage our resources, especially in specific areas. We've also seen a transition of our programs where we had groundwater and surface water. Those specialists, they were separated. Those programs were separated. And we're realizing that that won't work in our future, that those programs need to be connected, and that we need to have our groundwater modelers talking with our surface water folks. It is an interconnected system. Similarly, in the past, we've had our water quality programs and our water quantity programs, again, separated. But the future, those are very integrated because the quantity might be there, but if it's of a quality that's so expensive that it's hard to bring it up to our usable standards, then it's really not available to us. So we need to keep those both in mind. In the past, we've really focused more toward point-specific decision-making. What we now see is more of an integrated systems view. We're going to watershed approaches, groundwater management areas, and better quantifying and identifying those relationships. We've gone from, you know, looking at impairments stream reach by stream reach to looking at a watershed scale and all the factors that play into it, recognizing that as we do management, as executive branch functions, we need to consider quantity, quality. We need to look at the ecosystem needs, human society, and balance that with our economy, our way of life, all those things that make Minnesotans proud to be here, the things that remind us in a winter like this one that we still are happy to be calling ourselves Minnesotans. So the strengths of the plan are, first off, that it brings together all the various executive branch programs and talks to how they relate to each other, how it's benefited to be coordinated together. It does articulate consensus, and I think that that's powerful because it shows the commitment of the executive branch of understanding that we've done well in some areas in the past and there's some areas that need improvement, and we need to continue to look for those opportunities to grow and challenge ourselves to move forward with technology, with new information. And what this also does is this plan, this operating manual, is it promotes a dynamic and adaptive approach to water management. What this lays out is strategies and principles that can be used in all of our natural resource programs. And if we actually go back to make sure that we're on target with what it calls for, we will be adaptively and dynamically changing our programs in response to that. So our next steps, first off, are to operationalize the state water plan within the agency programs, to apply it to how each of these programs can continue to grow, build on the foundation from recent years. The other thing is it provides a framework. So as the legislature provides us direction in Clean Water Fund priorities, it allows us to most efficiently and effectively put those priorities in place. It also provides a context whereby we can look at the University of Minnesota framework. You know, it's important that the executive branch look at those recommendations and have a public dialogue about how those recommendations fit in alignment with our priorities and what we can operationalize today and what we need to be looking for incorporating in the future. And lastly, the EQB has put forth that we need to be meeting now and in the coming years to look at what we've targeted here in the state water plan and define milestones and steps to make sure we're making progress toward putting in place what we've outlined in the document. So I know that was a very quick overview for a 10-year document, but I thank you for your time, and I'd welcome any questions.
All right, any questions from the committees? Must be getting, I didn't see any questions. Senator Higgins.
Mr. Chair, I just wanted to say that I've had a great time listening to some really smart women today.
Yeah, well, thank you. Thank you, Senator Higgins. And we echo that. Great presentations. And nice to see someone from the EQB come. I served a couple terms on the EQB back in my younger days. But nice to see you there. And I certainly understand the what I felt was the importance of having all the agencies get together, at least 9 of them get together, because we all understand the intense pressures you get around here, and it kind of you worry about yourself and not much else. So glad to see you still going.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
No further questions. I think it's time to go do something else. We'll adjourn the meeting. Thanks a lot for your participation.
Yeah.